you have somehow ended up listening to The Stuff That's Real, That You Didn't Know Was Real, But Also Is Cool podcast. Or Sturti Dickwer Bayek. Or, never mind.
Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining us once again. We are your favorite podcast hosts, or at least, well, maybe not your favorite host, but we are the hosts of your favorite podcast. That is an objective fact.
Presumptuous of you to say.
Well, presumptuous or not.
In a world of Pat Flynn's and Joe Rogan's, how can we dare to be someone's favorite podcast
host? We are Joe Flynn and Pat Rogan. Coming at you live. We'll see if that gets us some SEO.
We should totally start a show, the Joe Flynn and Pat Rogan show.
We should. We'll see what they see. What anybody says. Yeah. See how quickly we get sued. No. You know, getting sued aside and SEO aside and all the other things aside, we have some things for you today that we are going to talk about that I'm excited to jump into. Kevin, I was hoping that you wouldn't mind jumping in first. Well, I just can't wait to hear what you have to say about these guys. I've watched the show.
You've watched the show.
Let's just put it that way.
Okay.
Yep.
I didn't know there was a show.
It's called Turn.
Oh, is that based on this?
It's not necessarily this book. I think there was a book called Turn, but it's about Washington's
spy ring. But it's about this thing. Yeah, okay. So, no spoilers.
Sorry. I mean, it's about the thing that you're talking about today.
So, yes. Okay.
Because I'm assuming nobody's read the title of the episode or the show notes when this has been posted. Man, they're the dark of it as
I am. Fair enough. Okay, so I'm talking about the Culper spy ring, otherwise known as George Washington's Secret Six. And this was essentially like before the Avengers, there was George Washington's Secret Six. That's what this kind of feels like when you start reading this. And basically, when the British were invading and George Washington was leading Americans in the American War, the Liberation War, as some of us call it. So back in September 1776, we were not doing well. There kind of came a point where we were losing, frankly, and started to rely on more guerrilla-style tactics. And one of those was George Washington formed this spy ring, which he named the Culper Spy Ring. The code name for it was named after Culpeper. It was the name of the region, or the town, or wherever where they were, I guess, where they sort of founded it.
Yeah, and I believe they called the main guy, Washington gave him the nickname Culpeper.
Yeah, Samuel Culpeper.
Name. Yeah.
So Townsend is the actual name
of
the guy. There's Talmage and Townsend, and those guys were riding back and forth to a guy named Woodhull, which is the guy who kind of ran all the day-to-day of the ring out of Long Island. And Townsend was, codename was Samuel Culper Jr., and Woodhull's name was Samuel Culper Sr. So, you know, it was this whole like spy back and forth thing. Now, these guys, they employed all kinds of cool stuff. They used a method of invisible ink to write letters back and forth to each other. And that was how they kind of kept the messages secret. So they would send actual letters that were just mundane day-to-day stuff. And then they would actually encode things. Sometimes they'd use code within the letter itself, like keywords, stuff like that. Sometimes they'd flat out write secret messages in an invisible ink that they invented. And you had to have the correct solution, the correct, I don't know what you would call it.
Like cipher or something?
Not the cipher, but like the chemical that they needed to react
with. Oh, yeah. Okay.
They weren't using like lemon juice or milk or whatever, you know, the things that you learned when you were a kid to use as invisible ink. They had something pretty cool. So,
I mean, they had to basically invent some new stuff because this is the British Empire who had at this point a long and storied history that we all know of military prowess, which must have included, and it does include, it included, you know, the British Empire would have had a pretty elaborate spy ring of its own.
Yep.
And many, many centuries probably of history of this exact sort of espionage and these tactics. And so the American side just inventing this stuff, many of these people had never served in anything but an organized militia or even a loosely organized militia. So they were just making it up as they go along. So what I love about this whole story is that, like, in some ways that gave them the advantage. You know, because just like Braveheart, the Patriot, the movie The Patriot, they're all hiding in the woods and the British don't fight like that. and they're not, you know, adhering to the rules of warfare. They're inventing new rules. And so
and it was really interesting because at that time, I mean, right up until even the Civil War, like war was very regimented. Like people literally, I mean, I remember we went to Gettysburg and listened to some things, saw some sights and stuff about the Battle of Gettysburg. And they literally would just march out as they were being shot at, you know, because that was the way you did it. You, you marched in a straight line.
Good job.
Toward your fate, and your fate was in God's hands. So this ring, by the way, is credited with uncovering Benedict Arnold, famously known as the American traitor. Also John Andre, he was the chief intelligence officer
for the Brits,
British forces. And he was actually hung in October 1780 on George Washington's orders. So there was a lot of intrigue and espionage there. Where I first heard about this was in a book by Brian Kilmeade, you may have heard of. He's done some stuff on like History Channel and stuff like that. He's written several books on a variety of topics. As a resource for thriller writers, I think he's one of the best authors out there. But he wrote a book called George Washington's Secret Six. And the subtitle was The Spy Ring That Saved the American Revolution. So I have a personal history with this. Actually, Nick may or may not realize this, but he and I have a personal history with this book. Which is the first time I heard about this. Yes. And what it is I was in an airport on my way to Colorado Springs for the very first time that you and I met.
Oh, okay.
And I bought this book. This was the first time we met in person.
So you're the one person who still buys hardback books in
airport bookstores. I'm the one guy. I was in the airport.
How can I spend $75 in the next 5 seconds? Oh, I have an idea. Let me walk into this bookstore.
It just intrigued me, and I didn't want to read it on Kindle for some reason. I don't know. Every now and then, I want to pick up a paperback and read it. You know,
but, I like nonfiction, especially these biographical history books and hardcovers.
Yeah, these are nice. Yeah, and of course, guys like us read this stuff for a variety of reasons. You know, for the entertainment, but also for the research of it. So I've read a ton of these, and also it had come out like that was I was coming your way shortly after my birthday, and it actually had come out that the day that it was in the airport.
Okay.
So it was brand new. Yeah. Because it came out on October 18th, 2016 was the release date, right? So that, you know, I was flying into Colorado Springs. Some other reason, really, I think, but the bonus was that you and I would meet in person for the first time. So I was thinking about the Culper Spy Ring. Yeah. The whole time you and I met. Thinking spies.
Kara came up that time too. I think she was with family a lot of it, right?
Yeah, she stayed with their family, and I drove from Denver to Colorado Springs.
You took the murder risk, and she wasn't going to do that.
Right.
I mean, I lived in a cabin at the top of a mountain. It was a dirt road, like a sketchy dirt road that you couldn't get in without all wheel drive at some parts of the year. And so you were like, sure, that sounds like a great place to go spend an evening or two.
You joke, but that was exactly what was going through my mind.
Yeah, you're like,
I come up the mountain and there's this big giant sign somebody like hand painted.
Oh yeah, that was Pat.
So first of all, let me set the scene here. Pat. When I say I drove up the mountain, I don't mean like there was street lights and homes on either side or whatever. I'm like literally I end up on a dirt road at some point. Mm. It's looking kind of sketchy. Let's just put it that way.
I mean, it's a one lane road. I mean, there's no.
Yeah, it's one lane.
You stay on the road or you fall off a cliff. Yeah.
This big hand painted sign, right as I'm entering what should be considered, what might be considered Nick's quote unquote neighborhood, that says, "Trespassers will be shot." So I went anyway, full of faith that my friend Nick was on the top of that mountain.
I was real. I was up there and I was waiting, sipping some whiskey. It was a good time. I remember that. That was great.
So at that time I was reading about the Culper Spy Ring, and I've been fascinated by this ever since. Like I said, I kind of think of it like, you know, this is like Washington's Avengers.
It is.
Because these guys were risking it all. And if you read the book, you learn there were more than just men involved in this. There were actually some women involved in the ring.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. So I've seen the show Turn.
Yeah.
I think it's History Channel, but usually not, History never does any actually history shows.
Yeah.
They're like, what about aliens? How about that?
It's the Histrionics channel.
You know, so I started watching the show with my dad. It's admittedly a little slow. You got to be a big fan of history. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
It's fictionalized and it's very good. It's very well made. It's very well produced, well directed. The acting is great. The question I had was if they fictionalized the main Talmadge. No, not Talmadge. Yeah. Whoever Culpepper was, we said.
There were two Culpeppers, but yeah.
Culpepper the younger. He would have been the main character in turn, I believe.
Townsend.
Yeah, that sounds right. He was a farmer's son and real hothead kind of dude. Smart, but you know, he was like, let's go stick it to him. And his dad was like, let's not. His dad was actually involved with the British, just trying to, you know, play nice with both sides. He was a diplomat, a local diplomat. Anyway, the younger one, who the series is about mostly, follows him and his love affair with this woman who ends up also being in the spy ring.
Right.
And she helps out and stuff. And they do it in a way that I don't think they could fictionalize her entire, you know, story.
I think Anna Smith Strong?
That's exactly who it is. Yep. Anna Strong.
They think she was actually much more heavily involved than people think. That she may actually have been, at one point or another, she may have been like Culpepper Sr. in the ring.
Okay. Yeah, I could see it. I mean, I didn't finish the series. We lost interest. I was staying with my parents, and so my dad and I would watch it. And I tried to get Emily to watch it. I kept joking with her. I was like, the next episode, it gets really good.
Yeah.
The next episode, it gets really, really exciting. She wanted just more, you know, more to happen, but it was very slow burn kind of show.
So this is one of the things I wanted to make sure I called out in the vein of the stuff they were doing that was all spy related, right? So she actually worked out a code that involved her clothesline, her laundry line.
Yes, they do that in the series. Yep.
And she would basically hang things in a certain order or hang up certain garments, and they meant
there'd be a black garment in the series. I think it, you know, she did that, and that means she had a message from, because she was like the caretaker of that, or it was her house that the British took over.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the British guy living there would be having meetings and stuff, and she would spy and get information and then pass it on to the Talmadge, I think it was.
Yeah.
So that show, first of all, she's super hot, so it's worth watching. She's just gorgeous.
I'm guessing that's probably not historically accurate.
Well, I assume it is. I mean, everybody looks exactly the same way, and they only cast people who look as good, and they're equally as clean as they were back then. No, the George Washington actor is absolutely phenomenal, in my opinion. I think he just nails. So I've read, is it Ron Chernow? Maybe it's McCullough. I can't remember who wrote Washington's biography, the real famous one.
That may have been McCullough. I'll find out.
It's a huge book, you know, and I read the whole thing, and I was riveted. I love Washington, one of my favorite men from history. And this character, this acting and writing, really captured that feel for who Washington was and how he operated. Just stand-up dude, you know, respectable, quiet in a lot of ways, you know, not interested in social stuff and social scene and all that. Not interested in, you know, running a war either. He was just doing it hesitantly because it was the right thing to do. Just really checks all those boxes in the show. And then the second character that is riveting is John Andre, the British spy.
Yeah.
He is absolutely phenomenal, whoever that actor is. Just really, really well done and just... And not villainy, you know, not like I remember the villain from Patriot was one of the scariest villains they put on TV, in my opinion, just because he was through and through. You could just see his evil ruthlessness, you know, in his eyes. John Andre, you're like, you really like him. Like, I know you're on the wrong side, but dude, I really want you to win. Well, you know?
And depending on, you know, you actually might not be. That's what was interesting about the Revolutionary War, because depending on what nation you were from, you were on the right side or the wrong side.
What nation you were from, if you were a Tory or, you know, like, I mean, yeah, it was very easy, I assume, to swear loyalty and fealty to one side or the other, almost, you know, 50-50 down the middle, which is why it was such a difficult war, right?
I have a British friend who named Martin Ridgway, who I actually interviewed on my other podcast.
You don't have, there are no other podcasts besides this one. we'll delete that.
Every year on July 4th, he sends me a message wishing me a happy seditious traitor day. So
exactly. Well, as a very English person myself, I chose the correct side.
Are you an Anglophile?
I'm an Anglophile, yeah.
You are an Anglophile? Yeah, me too. Yeah. I think I am.
Thacker, I mean, that's like the most English name ever.
Tomlinson. Come on.
Tomlinson. I mean, that's like a hobbit. It's like
you
a hobbit.
You don't get much more. Which is ironic because that's an adopted name for me, and my actual family heritage is much more like Irish, and I'm a Scottish laird.
Yep. So, well, that's just because you bought some like Ardbeg or
bought
whatever
some land in Scotland. Yeah. So Ron Chernow is the author of Washington, A Life.
A Life. That's the one I read. About.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. I'll link to that one in the show notes too. Fantastic book. Anything Chernow writes is great. First one of his I read was about Rockefeller. It's called Titan.
Yeah.
Fantastic book. Just incredibly well
written. What's interesting to me, man, and I think this speaks to the would-be thriller authors in the audience, okay? What's interesting to me is how when I was younger, and I'm talking all the way up into my 20s or whatever, you couldn't have paid me to read books like this, right?
Yeah.
I read plenty of books, okay? But you couldn't have paid me to read anything about Washington. And now I just tear through these things like I can't get enough of them.
Yeah.
And I think that comes from being a writer, actually, because you sort of deplete your knowledge on a topic when you're writing about it all the time.
That's what I was going to say, is like you got a tank full of creative ideas and you just are constantly draining it as a writer and you have to refill it with something. Right. Sci-fi and history books are kind of the two for me that I can't get enough of. Obviously, thriller. I pretty much read any new thriller that pops out if I can, you know.
Yeah. A lot of my research came from comic books, believe it or not, early days.
Comic books.
Not so much now. They're not as intelligent now.
No,
they go out there and tell
back then, because they were reading sci-fi and coming
they
up
were
with
reading sci-fi, you know, history,
right.
Poetry. I was exposed to a lot of poetry by Robert Frost and some others through comic books. You know, you can make fun. I was exposed to Shakespeare through comic books. So
I'm sorry.
You're sorry?
I'm sorry. Shakespeare.
Then I was exposed to Shakespeare.
I hate English people.
It's come on. Anglophile. Yeah, all right. All right,
anyway,
so that's my guy. That's my thing.
Guy.
The American Revolutionary Avengers.
Well, I have, I guess, the opposite of the Avengers, and in some sense. We are going to talk about the weirdest official race I've ever heard of. I mean, honestly, this is, maybe there's a weirder race out there. This is weird because it's the official Olympic Games. I mean, this is it. This was the 1904 World's Fair. In St. Louis, they hosted the Olympic Games. It was actually part of the World's Fair.
Okay.
And this is back in, you know, the early 1900s. We did it in St. Louis because it was the centennial, the Lewis and Clark Expedition. Sorry, not the Lewis and Clark. Louisiana Purchase was in 1804. It was right after, I believe, the Lewis and Clark stuff. But they decided to do the Olympics in St. Louis, and they didn't do it very well. And here's what I mean. Specifically, the area they did it in was extremely dry this time of year. It was very dusty. It was just already a terrible, it was 90 degrees plus the entire time. It was just already a terrible, you know, weather time. And of course, this is a time in American history when we decided it would be smart to wear long sleeves and suit jackets and hats and pants and dress shoes and socks that went up to our knees, just really overdressed. And so everybody was probably hot and sweaty and gross anyway. And they decided to have a marathon as part of these Olympics. So they ran the Olympics and, of course, decided to also make it like a science experiment. At this time in American history, at least, if not world history, there was a lot of experimentation with dehydration. They wanted to see how far people could go without, you know, dying and collapsing of dehydration. So they decided this Olympics marathon would be not only just a race, 24 miles, but they decided they were going to test some dehydration as well. So the organizer decided not to allow water for most of the, there was like two spots that you could get a little bit of water and they would limit how much you could get as a racer. So that was one thing they had going for it. There was like 6 inches of dust on the ground. Like it had been dusty and windy and all that. And it finally just settled. So as they started running, all these cars would be driving next, because again, we had cars then, and they would be driving next to the road, kicking up dust. Everyone's screaming at these runners. And so there were so many runners that couldn't breathe. They just, like, one of them actually, let's see if I can find where the runner, which one it was. James Sullivan was the organizer who wanted to minimize fluid intake to test the limits and effects of purposeful dehydration, which was a common area of research at the time. But yeah, cars, these coaches and physicians motored alongside the runners, kicking up dust, launching coughing spells. So William Garcia of California almost became the first fatality of an Olympic marathon. He collapsed on the side of the road and was hospitalized with hemorrhaging because the dust that he was breathing in had coated his esophagus and ripped his stomach lining. And this isn't like just, oh, there's a little bit of dust in the air. Let me put a bandana over my head. Let me wear a mask. This was like hemorrhaging, and it said if he had gone unaided in another hour, he would have bled to death. John Lorden was a racer, was a runner, and he suffered a bout of vomiting because of this and completely gave up. As if this wasn't enough, Kevin, Lin Tao, one of the South African participants, was actually chased for a mile off course by wild dogs. So this is like this apocalyptic scene. You've got dust in the air. These guys are running. It's like zombies are chasing them, and they decide to just release the dogs and, you know, whatever. My favorite part, and I can say that because these guys are all long dead now, so I apologize, dudes. But Felix Carvajal was a Cuban. He was pretty well known. He was kind of a celebrity runner. He ran at one point the entire length of Cuba to raise money for this thing. So he jumps on a ship and floats over to the Americas and lands in St. Louis with his dress clothes. He's got a, you know, a long sleeve white shirt on. He's got long knickers and dress shoes. They call them street shoes, but they're like these fancy, you know, clacky heeled dress shoes we used to wear. So he shows up. He's like, "Hey, I'm here to race." And they're like, "Great. We're about to start. Jump up on the starting line." So he's running in like these clothes.
Yeah.
Famous racer, famous runner. So trotted along, you know, for a little while in his cumbersome shoes. And eventually he stopped. He was like, "Well, I'm just going to chat with people and hang out." He stopped a car. He asked for peaches. Somebody was eating peaches inside the car. And they said no. So he snatched a couple of them. It says playfully. I like that little adverb, as if they know. Playfully snatched a couple of them and ate them as he ran. So you got this celebrity runner in like dress clothes holding two peaches running down this dusty road. There's wild dogs over here chasing Lin Tao. And so, you know, oh, and then Felix comes back later. He gets hungry again and he finds an apple orchard and he decides to snack on some apples. This is all during this 24 miles. People are supposed to be running. However, these apples were all rotten. And so he suffered from stomach cramps immediately. He laid down and took a nap. Sam Melor was apparently in the lead at one point. He experienced severe cramping. And so he started walking and then eventually just stopped. At the 9 mile mark, somebody else got cramps. So he just decided to get into one of the cars that was running alongside this race. Started waving at everybody, just passing everybody by. He actually won the race. So he rode 11 miles, got to the very end, and gets out of the car and decides to, you know, run the rest of the marathon and crosses the finish line. And the crowd starts cheering and going, "Oh, an American won. Yay, whatever." Alice Roosevelt is 20 years old. This is President Theodore Roosevelt's daughter. She's there. And she starts putting like the medal over his head. And one witness is like, "Dude, that guy cheated. Like, he was in the car though. We all saw that, right?"
Right.
And everyone goes, "Boo, you know, whatever, America, America, whatever." And then so Lors, you know, plays it off. He's like, "Oh, I was never going to accept it. I just, it was a joke, you know, whatever. Sorry." This whole thing, man, so there's another guy named Hicks and he's got a team with him. He's like got these handlers and they're going to help him get through this course. And of course, because it's 19-0-freaking-4, they decide that in order to, I should add, there are no anti-dosing laws or anti-drug laws at this point in the Olympics. So you can do whatever you want to win, whatever edge you need. And of course, we hadn't discovered anything useful. We've discovered things like, let's feed him egg whites and strychnine instead. And, you know, of course, this is a, like a, I think it's a chemical used as like a pesticide, but it gives you a little bit of a stimulant, a boost, of course, in non-lethal dosage. And, you know, so they give him this thing and he gets like ashen and limp. They're basically killing him slowly. They refuse to give him water. Instead, they give him brandy because that helps wash down the strychnine, I guess. They soak his body with warm water. Of course, he still can't drink the stuff. They just sprinkle him with it. And so he just stops working. His body just shuts down. Mm-hmm. So instead, he starts hallucinating. He thinks the finish line's 20 miles away when he was in the last mile. He begged for something. Then he begged to lay down. They still won't give him anything. They give him more brandy. They give him two more egg whites. And then he walks up the last two. Oh, I didn't talk about the hills. This whole stupid course has a bunch of hills on it. It's not even flat. They have to go up and down these hills as if that's like 24 miles isn't enough, you know?
Yeah.
And he jogs down the last hill and he gets into the stadium, but he can't run anymore. So the trainers, of course, wanting him to win, pick him up and they just carry him over the finish line and he's declared the winner. He loses 8 pounds in the course of the race. It took 4 doctors and 1 hour for him to feel well enough. I'm just imagining what these 4 doctors are doing. Like, well, let's give him more strychnine. Let's douse him with water. Let's cover him with gasoline and light him on fire.
You can't douse him with water because the whole, you know, the experiment would be
ruined. The experiment's still going on. Oh my God. This whole thing was just a cluster. Epic, man.
Reading through the article you shared, it mentions that this was part of the whole World Fair in St. Louis. And it talks about the anthropology days, which we'll talk about in a second.
But I was hoping you would bring that up. Oh my God.
We actually went to St. Louis a few years ago and we actually went to the site of the World's Fair and everything. They've got like these buildings and museums and things. Reading through all this, we discovered the anthropology days and all the things they were doing. This, I mean, it's kind of weird to think that some of the things that were happening were ever acceptable, ever.
Ever.
Like, it's not just looking back on this with, you know, modern humane eyes, but like the whole anthropology days thing was they imported quote-unquote savages.
Yeah, and that is in quotes. Let's just be sure we say that it's in the article. This is Smithsonian, by the way. So they said quote-unquote savages.
Yeah, they would bring in tribesmen from Africa and other regions, and basically they put them on display in these little villages and forced them to do the things that they thought should be done by savages. So, you know, you've got these people who otherwise would be living fairly normal lives back home now have to forcibly like cook a meal over, you know, have to kill an animal and cook it over a small fire that they're allowed to build and things like that. Like, just for the sake of authenticity.
And it says, and this is Smithsonian again, their direct quote, the controversial anthropology days in which a group of quote unquote savages recruited from the fair's international villages competed in a variety of athletic feats, among them a greased pole climb, quote unquote ethnic dancing, and mudslinging for the amusement of Caucasian spectators.
Wow. That's the stuff, man. Now, I just want to point out, by the way, that science was telling us to do all this. So.
Science, of course, but
just the science.
Get them all freaking in and have them run with no water.
That's too controversial. That's me kidding. So that is fantastic. That whole story is fantastic.
This whole thing, I discovered this and I was like, wow, that is a stuff that is real. I don't think this was cool. This isn't in the cool realm. I mean, it's cool as far as like a freakish moment of history, but holy crap. Yeah.
But it does tell you something, right? So like it makes you think. So when the criticism that I always heard about the books, Susan Collins wrote Hunger Games. Was it Susan Collins?
Yep.
Yeah. The criticism about Hunger Games was always that it was too far-fetched and wild that society would ever collapse to where something like that could be possible.
Nope.
And then you read history and you discover, holy crap, we had our own Hunger Games right here in St. Louis. Back in 1904, basically, we already did it. So you want to loop it. I don't want to step on your toes, man. Do you want to loop this back around to a whole thriller author or any kind of author thing?
Well, I was going the same route you were going. Like, there's a literal quote in this article that says the Olympics signal event, the marathon. And we all know the story, right? It's the Greek guy was running. He ran 24 miles to just say, hey, they're coming or there's war or whatever. And then he collapsed and died. Right. So it was this whole thing in the Olympics was conceived to honor the classical heritage of Greece and underscore the connection between the ancient and modern. And I'm like, modern sucks. Like, we have fallen far from this classical heritage and this beautiful, you know, Roman Colosseum where these guys are running. Like, that's, I'm sure that I'm over sensationalizing and over stylizing history because the people have always done shitty stuff. But I feel like humanity has risen up to this pinnacle moments and then fallen. And it's just this endless cycle. And I don't think the first time we were ever considered, you know, classical heritage and this, that we just fit this kind of mold was in Greek history. I think there's even more reason to believe that essentially we've lost so much of history and humans have been around for so much longer than anthropologists and archaeologists are letting us believe that they're refusing to acknowledge it. We've got proof of this now coming out left and right. Civilizations here in the United North America that's existed so much longer than anybody thought. And everyone who's officially, again, I'm making finger quotes here, in a capacity to say yes or no, this happened, is all of a sudden scratching their head going, well, I mean, I don't know. Probably not, but I would, you know, whatever. So I'm like, no, we were like, you know, apes and we walked up and decided to, you know, live in a little cave together. And then we became a civilization and we've just been declining ever since is what I'm getting to.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, in some ways, we've just been kind of going down and declining ever since. And I don't know, maybe you know, 100 years from now, we're just going to be apes again, living in a cave.
What came to mind metaphorically here, because yesterday was the day in our time, yesterday was the day that William Shatner went up into space and came back down. It was like a 11 or 12 minute ride, you know? And when he came down, I mean, he was so moved by the whole experience. But one of the things he said was he commented on how, you know, air, like, he's saying this like thin layer of air. It's like thinner than your skin, you know? It's like it was this instant thing. He just connected with that idea that we are just a hair away from death, as he called it, you know, because there was life, the blue sky, and then there was suddenly, bam, there was death, nothing but black. And there's not much between us and that. I think that's a pretty apt metaphor for civilization. We are only ever in a sort of thin bubble of civilization that could just burst at any time given the right nudge. And yeah. So, you know, history has just proven that again and again. And, you know, when you look back, if you look back at the history of the World's Fair, there's no wonder that you don't hear much about it now.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Like the only time you ever hear anything about the World's Fair is usually the Chicago World's, which
is that where Edison electrified an elephant?
I think you're right.
Is that the
I think
same
you're
one?
Right. If you yeah. start looking at the history of this thing, though, like it was a mix of celebrating our innovation mm-hmm. and doing some truly atrocious things.
Yeah. In the name of innovation, right?
In and the this name is, of it, innovation.
It was. It wasn't like, innovation like I've cured this disease and everyone's going to be, you know, it was like, no, we killed 18 school children in order to find a polio vaccine.
Well, and like purposefully dehydrating Olympians as they run. Come on. Right. You know, it's no far stretch to realize that keeping water from someone who is vigorously exercising is going to cause harm. We already knew that thousands of years ago. So what was that about? So that's why. By the way, I'm going to step on my soapbox for just 30 seconds here, but that's why you can't simply trust science. You have to question everything because sometimes the science is not on your side.
I'm with you
there. Now I'm speaking as someone who's a huge fan and believer of the scientific method and science in general and history.
What you're saying is like the scientific method is there so that we can question things. The scientific method is a process-based orientation toward finding an answer. And when we say something like, you know, can't trust science, we're not saying that that's all bullshit. We're saying that don't just take things at face value. Go figure out how the scientific method was used. Was it used appropriately? Was anybody harmed in these experiments that they're doing to reach this conclusion?
Right.
I would say, yes. Hey, we understand now that dehydration kills people. Cool. Well, if this is how they found out by withholding water from Olympians,
right?
I'm not sure that's worth it. I think we can probably make some educated guesses about the dehydration.
Probably could have figured it out without torture.
Something else, you know?
Yeah. So yeah, that's what always gets about these kind of stories. Like, was there not a single person who stood back and said, maybe we shouldn't be greasing a pole and making people from Africa try to climb it? Like, nobody? But again, the hard part about this is we're looking at this through the lens of 2021, right?
Where we know a lot of things that we didn't know or think we didn't know.
And that's the other thing that I try to get across to people is that we can look back at history and be very critical of it through the lens that we currently use. But you have to be able to look back at that and say it was a different time. People were treated very differently back then. The attitude towards just about everything was very different. And I don't think it's quite just to come down on an entire culture based on these heinous acts that they committed in the past, if they grew past them, right?
Right.
There's a reason we don't do this anymore, right?
Right.
We grew up. So you can't, I don't like the idea of, you know, judging anyone based on the worst thing they ever did. I've always hated that.
But, well, you can't look at this whole thing. Let's take the, you know, in recent news, Facebook went down. There was a whistleblower thing. It was all conspiratorial and stuff. Anyway, I have lots of thoughts about that. But the whole, you know, Mark Zuckerberg comes out and says, well, this isn't my fault. This is society's fault. And my first response is, who the fuck do you think society is, Mark? It's you. It's me. It's us. It's individual people collectively making decisions that look like a collective decision. And so you don't get to just paint with a broad brush and say, well, I didn't do anything. It's society, because you are society.
Yeah.
So the same way, man, we don't get to look back at history in a different society, if you will, different culture, and say, well, society's at fault. We have to recognize that, okay, cool. Yeah, there's individual people making individual decisions that are really shitty that lead to us saying all of society was this way. But that's once oversimplistic, as much as it is true. There were individual people who decided this was a good idea. There were individual people who decided, you know, we're not going to give water to these people. It's their fault.
Right.
Right. It's not society has decided we all should do something. It's no, there's individual people. We're just too lazy to find them and crucify them.
I'm a big fan of take responsibility for your own actions.
Absolutely.
And learn from the past. And this is definitely a story that we hope we have clearly learned something since this happened. I don't know if anyone learned anything specifically from this event that still resonates today. I can't say. I can say that looking back at this, my hope in humanity is that somebody saw all the things that were going on in this crazy ass marathon and said, we're probably better than this, or at least should be.
Yeah.
And then that made a difference.
Because it got better, right? This isn't how we do the Olympics. So at some point there was some, you know, decision made that, hey, we can make more money from this whole shebang without the, you know, the ethnic dancing of savages and Greece pole climbing. So naive to think that money's not involved. So I think that was, for better or worse, you know, capitalism stepped in and said, you guys want this to be success and want more people to tune in and enjoy it. Get rid of that shit. Do the athletics only.
That to me is the hope of humanity right there. Is that
capitalism?
Yes and no. Not capitalism itself, but the spirit behind capitalism.
Not the end, but the means to the end.
Not the greed.
Right.
It's not about greed. It's about where does civilization want us to go rather than where we are. And then the system responds to that. And capitalism is one of the tools that makes that happen. Whether you like it or not.
It can be used for evil. It can be used for good. And I think of it as when things are operating the way they should, it's competitive. It's healthy competitiveness for the betterment of mankind. And that's what we've seen with, we have private space flights taking Captain Kirk to space. This isn't the government doing it. This isn't society doing it. It's individuals who decided, well, I've got so much money, I'm going to live out my childhood fantasies and get people to space. Say what you want about all that money. That's what brought Will Shatner to space.
So, there were two other civilians on that flight.
Yep.
One of them was
it four people total? Or are you saying one was an astronaut?
I thought there were only three actual civilians, but I don't know.
Okay, I see what you're saying,
But there were at least two other civilians. One of them is the first full citizen of Australia to actually go into space. So there was another like historic moment there.
Yep.
But those other two, their spend on that, they popped $250,000 each.
Oh, I did for that.
Like 3 minutes of weightlessness.
Yeah, I do.
So, but what's interesting about that is a step toward you and I being able to hop in a rocket and go.
Absolutely. That's the whole point. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I mean, imagine how much the first e-reader cost, you know, back in the day, whatever, you know, the first tablet, the first car, right? Yeah. So this is obviously not going to always be $250,000. To just float for a couple minutes in space. This is just the beginning of colonization of the moon, of Mars, whatever. And it starts here. So you heard it here first, folks.
you heard it here first. History starts right now. One day to the moon.
The idea.
I want credit. I want credit for when we are all in space. So actually, I'm going to say this one last thing about that. I know we're off topic the talk of Shatner and everything, but seeing 90-year-old overweight Will Shatner go into space and come down with this effusive, like, emotional response to it was the first time in my lifetime that I honestly thought there's a shot at me being able to go into space. My whole life, I've loved everything about space. I've loved NASA. I built model rockets when I was a kid. I loved Star Trek. I've always dreamt of it, but it never felt attainable until William Shatner did it. And so that is all I'm going to say about that.
Well, that's I like for it. Now. For me, it was The Martian. Andy Weir, you know, makes a botanist, gives a botanist the ability to go to space. I'm like, I'm a trombonist. Maybe they'll need a trombonist in space someday.
You know?
Who knows?
Could be. Yeah. Could be.
I don't have my hopes up, though. We'll see.
Yeah.
All right. That was an exciting episode, I think. I think we took some cool turns and twists. And
it's amazing how that happened, by the way. From
just like all thrillers that we write is twisty and... Yeah. Hope you guys kept up. If not, you know, give it a re-listen. A lot of good stuff in here. Check out those books. I'll link them in the show notes. And of course, if you have anything you want to ask us or argue with us or give us an idea for another topic, we're big boys. We can handle it. Go ahead and send them to us. And you can do that by way of a thing called electronic mail. And that's hello@stuffthatsreal.com. We would love to hear from you. For Kevin, I'm Nick. Thank you for listening. I'm not going to do that to you. I'm just kidding. I just always thought it was funny that news.
I was going to sit back. You know,
for the person for Kevin, I'm not allowed to talk anymore.
I've cut off Kevin's microphone. Good night.
It's one of those polite things that we do that we don't think about. It's like when we say, excuse me, at the supermarket. We're really just saying, get the hell out of the way.
Pardon me. Pardon. I said,
you're
pardon
in my way. Excuse me. Sounds so much better. But that's really all we're saying. I don't actually want anything from you except to get the hell out of the way.
Exactly.
Anyway, get the hell out of the way. We'll see you
pardon
next week.
Pardon me, everyone.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.